when you hear that music, you know you are set up for an edition of Spiritual Perspectives. My name's Scout Bartlett. I'll be your host, and this is Spiritual Perspectives, taking a look at real life from, well, a spiritual perspective. We're glad to have you join in. I want to introduce you to a little bit about our guest today. This is an individual that grew up with people practicing spiritual healing and studies of spiritual healing through her whole life, but got to have some fairly adventurous things in her youth where she got to test that out and find out that you can indeed apply concepts of spiritual healing and concepts of background to everything from trauma events to physical events and so forth. Outside of that package, she's scored herself a couple of master's degrees and a PhD in educational policy, followed through cranking out kids, and experiencing life all the way across the spectrum, and even with all of that sort of mainstreamy background, is now following a path of being a full-time practicing spiritual teacher and a full-time practicing spiritual healer. So everybody, I would very, very much like for you to meet with me, Christy. Christy, and I never didn't check this, but I think it's Hanslick. So everybody,
right.
This is Christy, Christy Hanslick, and Christy Hanslick, this is everybody.
Hi, everybody. It's really great to join you wherever you are.
Yeah. Isn't it nice we got them all together?
Yeah. We're like one big happy family.
Everybody's here. Now, one piece that I noticed in reading some of your background, Christy, is one of my theories about life is that healing is not to be reserved for disease. And I can definitely see that we're in alignment with that. You mentioned, all right, we'll just start up with the nasty stuff. You mentioned that you got to be part of a carjacking experience at one time in your history. Tell us a little bit about that and also about being able to release the trauma that came with it.
Right. Wow, that's a throwback to when I was 17, actually. So for those of you who are close to 17, or for those of you who have daughters that are 17, you can imagine from both a parent perspective and as a pretty new driver. I remember I grew up in Houston, Texas, and we had just pulled up to a gas station. And my friend and I were so excited. My parents were out of town, so we had rented some videos from Blockbuster, if you remember that place.
Yep.
And we were going to just stay at home, watch some Blockbuster. Anyway, we pull up to the gas pump, and two men came up on either side of the car, held guns to our heads, and asked us to get out. And my...
Asked. That's a polite term. Asked us to get out.
Well, yeah. It was, I guess it was a little bit more aggressive than that. But I remember I was so startled. I said, well, can I at least get my purse? Which, in hindsight, was a ridiculous thing to say. But I did. I got out of the vehicle and just actually made a beeline to the payphone. And like I said, my folks were out of town. And it's in times like that, it's interesting. You kind of go instantly into prayer mode. And what I mean by prayer mode is looking for what's calm and certain, right where the whole world seems upside down, to just go for that calm certainty. And I called and let them know what happened. We got a ride home and, of course, filed all the appropriate police reports and things like this. Being in Houston, Texas, the statistics were that within 12 minutes, your car was stripped and you never saw it again.
Wow.
That's what we were looking at. We were fortunate not to have any injuries. So you had mentioned, Scott, already that I came from, a background of spiritual healers, and both my mom and my grandmother were spiritual healers as well. And the three of us were on a conference call talking about this. My grandmother, who was in a later time zone, was already up praying. Something had really just kept her praying. She didn't know why yet, and this apparently was it. And she was actually praying with that story in the Bible where Elijah borrowed the axe head from a neighbor to build a temple, and the axe head fell into the river. And an axe head was very, very valuable. So he had lost this. And he turned to what he knew to be certainty and calm, his faith in God. And the axe had floated in the river.
Wow.
And my grandmother, and then of course he retrieves it and everything's good. So my grandmother had already been praying with this axe head floats story. And as she shared
now,
it with me.
Let me just be sure. She was already up and happened to have been drawn to that story and was praying before she found out anything was going down in your world.
Correct.
Awesome.
Correct. My grandmother seemed to have that talent, and I'm finding that seems to have been handed down generations. So I'm grateful to seem to have that gift as well, to kind of have a sense of when my attention is needed. But yes, she was already up and with that specific story. So she shared that story with me, and at the time I had never heard it before. And it wasn't as much the story at the time, but rather her sense of calm certainty.
Nice.
That kind of her conscious awareness of calm certainty that all was well just made me feel this sense of calm. It was at that time that, like, right when I felt that sense of settled calm, that the other line rang, and I picked it up, and it was the police. And they had apprehended the perpetrators and had recovered the vehicle.
Wow.
So the next request was that I come in at 7 a.m. and identify the perpetrators and get the car back. Well, remember again that I'm 17. I got a ride there. And when I was at the police station, they let me know that there was actually a shootout with these guys when they did retrieve the vehicle, which to me suggests that they were serious. This wasn't they weren't playing with toy guns here. One
right.
of them was a Beretta. I don't know what kind the other gun was. But
doesn't really matter. If they're pointed at you, they all look big.
They look big, and you're not thinking, oh, is this a real gun or not a real gun? Right. So it was interesting. They tell you, one, when you're behind one of those windows, you know, at the police station, that even though the lineup folks can't see you, they can see shadows. And so they would look toward the shadows trying to intimidate the person identifying them. And so, you know, you've got five men, you know, older than me, staring toward my shadow, and I'm supposed to identify them. And what the police said was, you have to identify them. You have to be 100%. If you're wrong, they walk. And that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
So I did, again, what I know to do, and I prayed. And I prayed with a hymn. Well, it's a hymn and a poem, and it said, just shepherd, show me how to go, or the hillside steep. So no matter how steep the hill is, I knew that shepherd was going to be showing me how to go. And I just heard, clear as a bell, it's the man in the brown shirt. And I didn't waver. I didn't doubt. I had that sense of calm certainty. And I identified him, and it was right. And I didn't follow through to find out what, you know, the result was, or what his sentence was, or anything like that. I left it with that. I left with the car. We washed the car. And I kind of felt like that washing the car was kind of the purification.
Perfect.
Of the situation. And it was, you know, that was kind of a symbolic thing, I suppose. At that point, my dad had rejoined me. We had breakfast at IHOP and then washed the car. So that was our kind of symbolic thing. But what was most interesting to me, and I recognize it now more as an adult, is that there was no residual fear.
Yes.
That here I am walking, you know, I living in a big city. Shortly after that, I know I went to work as a summer camp counselor, and walking in the woods at night, walking past dark bushes or trees and things like that. And it now occurs to me how free I was of a sense of what, you know, people would call PTSD. I didn't feel it. And I just had this sense of freedom from that. I wasn't afraid to drive. I wasn't afraid to drive at night. I'm not afraid to go to gas stations to this day. Now I have a son who's driving, and I'm not afraid for him going to gas stations. And to me, that ability to turn during a crisis to a sense of calm certainty, and then having that comfort me during it, is what protected me later on to have that. Now, when I look back at it, you could look back at that experience and say, oh, that was horrible. How could that have happened to that little girl? You know, I don't see it that way. I see it as absolutely a moment in which my faith, my certainty, my sense of knowing that I have something to lean on that's bigger than me at any moment, that no matter what comes up in my life, I have that. That's what that experience means to me, and that's my takeaway. And to me, I think that's the great value of spiritual perspectives, as you point out.
That's a beautiful piece, and I agree 100% that you didn't have ripples of traumatic repeat or traumatic replay is probably even more amazing than the fact that they got your car back. But the undercurrent I'm hearing there, Christy, is the whole sense of once, and this is also from another piece of your writing that I had read, that whole piece of it's done, it's complete, I can already be in appreciation for the fact that whatever it is that was the mistake has now been healed, and that healing is done.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, it just now occurred to me that the other thing that I don't have is a sense of resentment toward those perpetrators.
Yeah.
I had never realized that before, but that's another piece of this, what I would call a healing. I think healing is when we feel that oneness with good and a oneness with a certainty of good. And so part of that, yeah, I don't have a, and I think that's probably why I'm not afraid too, is I don't see people as possible perpetrators. And if I met those men today, I would meet them with love. In fact, now I do some ministry in prisons, and I strive to look at everyone as without a record, right? And I know that I could look those men in the eye without a sense of resentment.
Yeah, because you're not carrying that forward. You let it clear.
Mm-hmm.
There's one other word, as I was reading another thing you wrote, Christy, that I really love and I wanted to explore a little bit, because it's a really interesting word to me, and that's the word S-I-N, sin. And you did a bit of a takeoff about sin and where we might want to stand with that word, different than the reflex repercussions it sometimes mm-hmm. generates.
Yeah, it's such a great word. I love talking about sin. I didn't even have to prompt you. It's so fun. No, you know that word trigger that a lot of folks are using in psychology and pop uh-huh. psychology today, like when a word triggers you or when someone triggers you. And I think that word sin is a trigger word, and what it triggers is guilt.
That, yes.
You know, as soon as we hear the word sin, we're like, oh, what did I do wrong?
Yes, or what is it about me that is wrong?
Yes, it's right where we all seem to go. And as soon as we hear the word sin in a context of spirituality, it tends to be a turnoff. And I'm not surprised about that. It's got a lot of connotations and weight. For a three-letter word, it sure has a lot of power. So I've done a lot of thinking and experimenting with sin so that I really feel like I have a grasp on what it really does. And so I talked about that calm certainty of good, that's what healing is. Well, to me, sin is feeling separated from that calm certainty of good.
Nice.
So whenever we feel separate from good, that's sin. Now, it can be something as little as accidentally walking out of the grocery store with something on the, you know, the bottom of the cart, and we didn't pay for it, and feeling guilty and separated from good. Well, you know, that's a pretty subtle sin, but, it, you know, that's what it is. It can be something more major. But even if we're just hard on ourselves, you know, even if we're just berating ourselves, or that inner critic, that can be a subtle form of sin. So what we can do is to constantly strive to feel that oneness with the certainty and calm of good. As we're doing that, we're overcoming sin. Now, when we're actively doing things that are like, you know, one form of good would be truth, right? So truth is good. If we're actively lying, then we're not going to feel really connected with truth. So lying is a sin. It's something that makes us feel separate. But when we take that kind of guilt connotation and we start with that acknowledgement that we are one with the certainty of good. The certainty of good is always present and available to us right now. We cannot actually get outside of it. We can realize that, you know, we're not constantly struggling with a sense of being separate, being sinners, but rather we can constantly acknowledge our oneness and get over that guilt piece. In my own experience, what I found was that when I stopped feeling guilty about a certain behavior and instead identified as someone who was certain with good and calm and at one with truth and so forth, that behavior, whatever it was, just fell naturally away.
Perfect. I love a phrase I heard in one other conversation, which was, if you suddenly notice that it feels as if you and God are separate, who do you think moved?
Yeah. You know, and the corollary to that is if God is ever present, and by God, I mean, I don't mean an anthropomorphic man in the sky kind of God. I mean, like, love. Love is ever present. Love is present where I am in Colorado, and love is present where you are in California, and love is present for each person listening in right now at the same time. So it's not like there's less of God or less of love because 20 people are feeling it versus a million people. So this idea of love being ever present simultaneously and infinitely, love is present on the moon. There is nowhere we could go where we wouldn't feel it. That's a measure of a spiritual concept, meaning instead of the word spiritual, I use the word unlimited.
Thank you.
So that idea of love is an unlimited concept. It never began. It never had a starting point. It never had an ending point. So when we begin to see that love is ever present, how could you possibly be outside of or separate from that? You can't. So therefore, anytime we feel that tug or that sense of guilt that starts to make us feel like a, quote, sinner, we can turn instead to feel that all-encompassing ever-presence of love. And that heals sin. That heals the belief that we could be outside of love. You know, I want to point out one more thing about that word guilt. If you switch the letter T with a E, it's guile. It's trickery.
Nice.
And it seems to me that guilt is one of the first things that turns us away from spirituality, from thinking in unlimited terms. When we think we're not worthy, when we think we're not good enough, when we think we've done something wrong, when we think we haven't done enough good, you know, any variant of that, it's the guile, it's the trickery that seems to make us think that we're not capable or we're not worthy of tuning in and being present with these ideas of the certainty of good.
So multiple times you've referenced coming back to that certainty of good and coming back to that quiet, centered place inside of yourself. And so that brings me in a roundabout way to a question I always like to ask in these programs, which is not an institutional definition, but your own experience. What do you experience and how do you know when you've hit it in the word or the verb prayer, to pray?
Well, you know, for me, prayer isn't sitting and pinching my nose and bowing my head. I joke around like, oh, let me pinch my nose on that, you know, when I want to pray. But it's a joke. I don't feel like you have to be even alone to pray. For me, I love to play sand volleyball. It's something, you know, anyone who knows me knows that's one of my passions. Yeah. And I do some of my best praying in the middle of a game. It's a sense of being in the zone. So athletes know what it means when you do something a lot and you're in the middle of a game and you feel like you're carried along. That's prayer. That's a form of prayer. And so spiritually being in the zone is when you feel a sense of certainty and calm. I keep using those words because I think they're very poignant right now and in what seems like a topsy-turvy situation that our country and our globe is in. But it's a certainty, a calm, a sense of centeredness, feeling loved. So if I needed to define prayer, I would define it as anything that you're doing that enables you to turn away from the outward appearance of things to look deep into realism, to those things that are certain, those things that are real no matter what.
Turn away from the outward appearance of things is just such a rich, rich, deep phrase. And I know from reading some of your background that you have seen lots and lots and lots of various healings, but we'll just use one that we know we can use because it's yours. So if the outside of appearance of things is necrotic flesh from a brown recluse spider bite, how do I turn away from that outward experience that's not a sense of denial, but is actually coming back to that certainty of good when my skin is still believing in a spider bite?
Right. And of course, you know, Scout's referring to a very specific healing that I had. Again, this is a banner year for me. I think I was 17 or 18 when that happened too.
Just throw your body at the world and fix it later.
That I might share later. In that circumstance, my leg was swollen, and to be transparent, I didn't have a medical diagnosis on that, but the symptoms are pretty consistent, and the brown recluse spiders were prolific in the area where I was, and I remember seeing the spider. So, you know, several days later, my legs inflamed. I was in tears because of the pain, and the pain had been increasing over some days. And I hadn't really been praying, you know, up until that time. You know, as a youth, oftentimes we're like, oh yeah, it'll take care of itself, and you just kind of
right.
Push through it. And that's kind of what I was doing.
Yep.
Until the pain got unbearable. And that's kind of what you're asking, right? Like, when it is unbearable, how can you say that that's not real or that's not, that's you can pray about it and have relief?
Yeah. Oh, how nice. We'll just pray and you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. When outward appearance is really speaking loudly.
Screaming, in fact. Yeah. Yeah. And so for me, one, I was in a pretty isolated, remote place, so there weren't a whole lot of other options besides prayer, which often helps us turn more quickly. But I was in such pain And I remember the only person who I got up to go to the bathroom at night, and it was in such pain. I was in such pain that I started crying. And the only person that heard me get up was my sister. And up until this time, my sister and I hadn't been super close. We fought a lot and so forth. But she heard me, and she came, and with such tenderness, this love that she had, and I know now that the love that she had was an expression of infinite, ever-present love. It wasn't just from her. This was an expression of an infinite, I would say divine love, that her tenderness was more than just person to person. And yes, she helped me to a place where I could be in an infirmary, where there was a healer. This is a Christian Science practitioner, someone who prays with the laws of Christ, basically following the way that Christ Jesus heals. And this woman was great. She was young and hip, and she had a guitar, and she just started singing to me. And basically, the feeling of being loved and being worthy eclipsed the pain. So that in this instance, it wasn't as much that I had to actively work to do this, but rather that divine love or shepherd, whatever word you're comfortable with, it really comforted me. And it eclipsed until I could not feel that pain. I remember I went to bed, I fell asleep to this beautiful guitar, with a sense of calm and a sense of, you know, I just fell asleep very peacefully, like a small child does. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and later on that night, and I went to the bathroom, and I looked on the floor, and I was like, oh, you know, somebody just bled all over the floor. They didn't even clean it up. And then I realized that it was the wound from my leg. It had completely drained. Now, what I love about this healing is, now that I'm a mom, it didn't drain in the bed. It didn't drain on the carpet. It drained on the tile.
You're a mom, all right.
I'm a mom. Yep. So, like, the cleanup was very easy. And so what I did, I was a camp counselor at the time, and the leg was completely normal in the morning. It went from, I don't know the measurement, but maybe 19 inches in diameter to my good, I have very muscly calves, so let's give it a 14 or a 13 inches. I don't know what it was, but anyway, it was completely,
it went from big
normal size.
Yeah.
And so I thought, you know, there was still a bit of an opening. So I covered it with a bandana. And what was pretty neat was the kids at camp then thought that was a pretty cool, trendy thing to do. So then everybody was wearing a bandana around their calves. So that became a trend that summer. But even that wound healed up within, you know, I don't know what the time frame was. I just went on my way. But within a couple days, that wound had completely closed up, never got infected or anything like that, even though I wasn't applying things to it. But so I think that's it, is in those moments, and I've experienced enough of them, where the crisis, whatever it is, seems like that's the outward appearance of things. That's what's so in your face. When we turn, even for a second, away from that to reach and be willing to listen or willing to feel the comfort of infinite, ever-present love, whatever that problem seems to be shrinks, and that love grows until you no longer feel that screaming of pain. But I think what might be necessary, and you know, I'm still learning, but I think what might be necessary is that willingness to turn away from it. So sometimes that willingness and that, you know, something screaming at you and you're in pain, sometimes it takes a very strong voice. Now, you and I know that voice. If we saw a small child walking towards a busy street, you and I would say, stop, stop right there. Now, if that child didn't stop, we'd say, okay, stop. If they still didn't stop, and I apologize to those on the radio, I'm going to use a loud voice. If that child still didn't stop, you would say, stop right there. Do not go any further. Now, that voice is not mean. There's no hatred in it. It is principled. It is strong, and it's full of love. You're using that voice of command because you love that child and you do not want them to walk into traffic.
Yeah.
Now, that voice, and all of us have it, all of us have that voice is the voice we can use with the body when the body is screaming at us in pain. That's the voice that we can use with a crisis situation. That's the voice that we as a country, we as a world can use right now with this virus situation that wants to turn our lives upside down. We don't have to let it. We can say, stop right there. We know that good is present. We know that love is still here. We're not going to let these little microbes undermine our sense of good. And how do you do that in the face of media clamor?
Yes.
Where there's billions of mentions of this in email, text, social media, the print media, everywhere. How do you stand up to that with that voice? Now, even if that child walking into traffic, say I was in New York City during busy time, my voice, my lone voice is enough to stop that child. Even if everybody else is talking about other stuff, my voice and that voice of command. And why? Because it's not just my voice, it's that voice of the shepherd coming out. Now, I don't know if you've ever been spoken to in that voice. A lot of us have moms that have had pretty strong voices,
yep.
So we've heard that tone before. It's an interesting tone because there's something about it that does make us literally stop in our tracks.
Cool. Speaking of stopping our tracks, I have to actually stop us for a half a second. And I hate it, but we're going to really quickly. Thank you so much. I'm always proud of those when I do that. We want to break away really quickly. I want to very much appreciate and thank the First Church of Christ Scientist in Mill Valley, who's coordinating a sponsorship for Spiritual Perspectives across a board of 50 various churches. They recommend that you are welcome to any Christian Science reading room that you see. They won't pester you, and/or they all have Sunday morning services and Wednesday evening services. Go check out spirituality.com and christianscience.com. You may well find out that this is an organized set of teachings that follow right along with what you've been seeking.
San Francisco.
Hey, when you hear that music, you know you're listening to an edition of Spiritual Perspectives. My name is Scout, like Pathfinder, Bartlett, like Pears. I'm your host, and today our wonderful guest that I'm just enjoying the daylights out of is Christy Hanslick. Delightful to have her here. So everybody, we've got Christy back again. Now, next place I'd like to go, and there's so many things I want to talk to you about, but the next piece that I'd really like to take a look at, you've got a really fun acronym that I read in one article, GLADARC. Can you do the short version of what that acronym is about in terms of successfully creating healing?
I'd love to. And in fact, for listeners, I don't know what the process is, but if people wanted to get a printout sheet of what it is there a way to make that connection? Can they go to your website?
The show itself will be archived on the website. Don't know that I'm set up to archive in with that a web link, but you can say it to them verbally. They can frantically scribble it down.
Okay. And I'll just do a plug too. You can also look at my website, www.christycs.com. So I'll put it up there. Okay. So Glad Arc is something that I came up with. You know, one of the first things that seems to happen to us when we're in a crisis or having a problem, and even if we're seasoned prayers, you know, we've been working on praying for 50 years or whatever.
I'm keeping that phrase, seasoned prayer. I am a seasoned prayer.
Good. Yeah. We all want seasoning on our foods. Yeah. Seasoned prayer. Yeah, that even if we've been doing this a long time, one of the first things that seems to come to us is you don't even know how to pray. You don't know how to do this.
Yep.
And it's a really sneaky, it's that guile, right? Oh,
yep.
We're not good enough. We don't know enough. So I came up with this acronym that is GLADARC, is an acronym to help us know that, yes, you do know how to pray. So that first G for GLADARC is gratitude. And the gratitude is real simple. It's not just, I'm grateful for this pretty puppy that I have. No, that's not enough. The gratitude that heals is when we have a problem or an issue, and instead of feeling like, oh, poor me, instead we say, yes. What an opportunity to learn more about the oneness of good.
Nice.
You know, so we flip it. Now we reverse the case. We are on offense. We're no longer on defense. So we've reversed the case, and we are now grateful for the opportunity. As soon as you do that, the healing has already begun. So that's the G of GLADARC. The L is next, and you've heard me say this word enough. It's love.
Yes.
Again, this isn't the love of, oh, I love chocolate or I love raspberries. That's not enough. It's not even the love that, like, when, you know, a checkout person is kind of rude to you and you're like, oh, well, I bet they had a hard day. I'll love them anyway. That's not enough. That's not a radical love that heals. This kind of love is different. This is like when someone's real difficult or you know, God forbid, hide card backs you, right? That you are able to see them as worthy of love. You are able to love them despite personality or despite individual characteristics. It's a love that transcends personality, transcends action,
nice.
Where you embrace them in. And it's not always easy, but that's the love that heals. It's a radical love. And I'd go more into it, but we're doing the quick of this. So that's the G, the L, the A is affirm the ever presence of love. And you heard me do that earlier in this hour, where we affirm that love is present here, there, all at the same time, that love is infinite. So love is bigger than whatever the problem is. So that would be the affirm. And then the D is deny. So the GLAD of GLADARC is to deny that anything could interrupt that goodness.
That's certainty
that there's anything
of good.
That could, go ahead, sorry.
I just said that's that certainty of good that you've referenced.
Right, right. And that denial, you know, that voice, that stern voice I used earlier, that's kind of sometimes that sternness is what it needs to deny something because it really seems in your face, but you've got to deny it. It is not a Pollyanna, rosy-colored glasses kind of denial.
Yes.
This is deny with certainty. And deny because you know that God is bigger than this problem. You know, it's a strong deny. So then you have your glad, and that's happy, right? Like glad is happy. So there's that sense of joy that goes along with that first four things. And so that joy is kind of carrying you along. Okay, now we get to the second word, which is arc, A-R-K. And the A-R-K, you know, we're familiar with that story of Noah's Ark, whether you believe it was an actual thing that happened or a metaphor, but the Ark symbolizes safety. And it's that safety that carries us, that lifts us above problems. So that's symbolically, that word ark is nice to remember too.
Mm-hmm.
The A is something that's somewhat, that really connects with my faith tradition of Christian Science, or the Science of the Christ, because that A is apply the specific law that overturns the situation. So, for example, right now in our communities and across the world, there seems to be an uncertainty. All of us seem to be checking the news constantly. What's going on with this virus? You know, what do we need to know from our government? We're looking to the highest branches of government to get a sense of certainty. We're looking to the news to find certainty. So to me, that's the underlying concern, that this virus seems to be taking away our certainty. So what I would do, if I am, and right now I am, praying about this issue, is I would take that A of apply the specific law, and I would apply, no, we can be certain of love. We can be as certain that love is present in each home. We can be as certain of that as we are certain that the sun will rise tomorrow. We don't doubt that the sun's going to rise. You and I don't have to stay up at night praying to make sure that the sun will rise. It already is going to rise. We don't have to chant in the morning trying to make sure it comes up each day. It does. And we can be so certain about that. And the reason we can be so certain that the sun will rise is because in truth, in reality, the sun is already there.
Yes.
The sun's not rising. The earth is turning. So the sun is never gone. And that's kind of what Christian Science does, is it looks at the science behind how Christ principles work, so that when you understand the how and the why, then you can be certain about it. And that's, you know, we're striving to do that. That's what we strive to do. And the textbook that we follow, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures by Mary Baker Eddy, is basically a textbook of laws and principles. So when I'm saying apply the specific law to overturn the situation, that's where I go to find those laws. So that's the A, and that one's kind of the most difficult to explain shortly, but that's the one. Okay, and then that's the first A of Glad Ark. And then the R is to, this is kind of a colloquialism, but reject the serpent in all its forms. Now, the serpent, I'm alluding to the story of Adam and Eve and how the serpent tricks them. The serpent uses guile. The serpent uses guilt to trick Adam and Eve. And this guile is all those subtle suggestions, that resistance. The author of Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, Mary Baker Eddy, she called it animal magnetism. I've heard some New Age prayers call it resistance. So, you know, whatever it is that seems to pull us away from good, that's what we're rejecting. So that's the R of Glad Ark. So one of those subtle suggestions is, what I'm doing when I pray is not enough. It's not enough. And so we would reject that. No. One light is enough to illuminate an entire room. Even if there's a crowd of people standing in a room in the dark, one person can turn on the light, and that's enough for the whole room. So what we do when you and I pray is enough to bring illumination for a whole crowd of people. So that's an example of how I would reject that specific little trickery.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the A and the R. And then the last one is a K, which is for know that your prayer is complete. So that's a K-N-O-W. So that's how it's a K.
It's that no.
Right. So know that your prayer is complete. know with certainty and calm that your prayer is complete. You can turn your back on it because you know that what you have done is enough, that your certainty and your sense of love is healing, that that healing is happening. And you can feel that resonate throughout you. And for me, I know when it's complete, when I'm free of anxiety, when I have that sense of calm, and I know that feeling. And sometimes when I'm praying about a physical issue, I'll have that sense of calm even before the physical change. So remember that story, you know, I shared about the brown recluse spider bite, that I had that sense of calm and peace when I went to sleep, even before the wound drained and closed up all the way. So sometimes it happens in that order, and sometimes it happens in the other order. I don't know that there's one right way for healing to happen, but I do know that it does, for me, always seem to be associated with that sense of calm and that sense of knowing it's complete. So if you don't know that it's complete and you're still feeling, then start again at the beginning with your GLADARK. And you go through that process of GLADARK until you can have that K, the know it's complete. So sometimes you'll have to go through it a couple times before you feel it. And then you get to the point, and I for the most part, it's where I feel like I am right now, where those seven steps become more like muscle memory, that you don't need to go through them as a routine. This is not a routine or a technique that you have to follow rigidly. I don't think that would fit with prayer at all. But it's like a guideline. And when you practice it, just like when a pianist practices their scales, once they've practiced it enough, you're not thinking actively about the scales. The soul of the piece, the soul of the scales just kind of takes over, and you see a pianist, you're in the zone. Whether, you know, I mentioned being athletically in the zone, you can be musically in the zone. And I think you can be, as a healer, you can just be in that zone where it's not an intellectual activity. And I think that these steps, you know, kind of help us get to that zone.
Perfect. At one point in time, I did a training to be able to jump out of perfectly good airplanes. And when one does that training, you actually do repeat out loud the instructions that you'll need your body to follow, which they explained was so that when your brain is busy going, you'll be repeating those instructions and doing all the steps. So you're kind of describing your GLADARK in the same way, that when your brain is going, you can kick that back in and put you back into that flow.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, that sounds exactly right. And I think you get to that point, and I described earlier that sometimes I do my best praying in the middle of a volleyball game, that it's that sense of flow, that it doesn't matter what you're, you know, physically doing, you can be having that awareness. Sometimes as a parent, I feel like I strive to be kind of constantly in that zone so that I'm alert and have a sense of equanimity. But I feel like to my kids, I don't know if they know that I'm always praying. So I feel like, gosh, am I role modeling right? Like, should I be sitting still, pinching my nose more often? And, you know, in those moments when I'm not sure like that, I just have to remember that those kids are not my kids. I'm a child too, and those kids are the shepherd's child. They have the same direct connection to divine love that I do. So they don't go from them to me, to the shepherd. That might be a segue, but it seems important that a healer might make it look real natural. That doesn't mean they're not working hard.
Yeah, yeah, working their work and walking their path.
Right, right.
so that you end up that when your 17-year-old granddaughter is creating spectacular ways to learn about healing, you're actually awake and working already.
That's right.
So yeah. There's a piece in here that you've got a background that your family gave you a background of being a healer, and yet you did like some serious college-y stuff that looks like serious grown-up-y kinds of stuff toward a serious linear kind of a career, and then you finish that, and instead of doing a linear career, you figured out how to take yourself full-time into healing. How'd you do that one?
Magic? No.
I'll go for that. I'm good with magic. All right, next question.
I love magic. Okay. I was an academic, and I love the world of ideas and intellectual history and so forth. And I loved exploring that, and I just couldn't take enough classes, and I kept going for more and more degrees. And I had a goal of earning my PhD and teaching at a Research One university and so forth. And that seemed very important.
Yeah, it must have seemed very real.
Right. Along the way, life gets hard. And home life wasn't satisfying. It was often very difficult. School got harder. You know, it was easy when classes came easily, but I finally got into an academic program where I was in over my head. Mm. And I had, and hopefully we all have these moments. I had a crisis of humility. I realized my home life was not good. This is in grad school. I'm almost 30 at this point. Home life was not good. Classes, to my degree of success, I was failing. Like on paper, my grades were okay, but to me, I knew I was failing, and I knew I could not succeed on my own. I wasn't going to be able to do this on my own. It was at that point, when I was finally in over my head, that I realized I needed to turn to something bigger than me. I needed to lean on something more sustaining than my own brain power or my own personality or whatever. That wasn't going to cut it. No matter how much I studied, no matter what I did, I wasn't going to be, quote, perfect enough or succeed. So at that point, when I was willing to turn away from myself as a source of strength and intellect to lean on something bigger than me, I turned to what I knew was more certain. And that would be this idea of infinite mind. I talked about infinite love. I think mind is kind of a synonym for God in the same way that love is a synonym for God. And,
nice.
Mind, when you think about mind or consciousness, well, you and I could pretty quickly reason that there's no beginning point to consciousness. There never was a moment when there was no thought in the universe. As soon as we can begin to conceive of that, of mind without beginning, then we're thinking about infinite mind. Now, even if you don't want to use the word God or religion or anything like that, if you can conceive of the fact that there never was a beginning point to consciousness, that's enough for me. That's prayer right there. Pondering infinite consciousness, that's prayer. That's probably a better definition than I gave earlier. But what I realized was I could lean on that. That infinite consciousness knows all. It knows every single grain of sand, which is countable infinity, knows every single leaf on a tree, every single planet, everything, all simultaneously, and the thoughts of each one of us. So I began to lean on that. And as I did that, my life just kind of turned. It was like a giant rotation, I guess, religious folks would use the word repentance, to repent, to change direction. Quickly after that, I knew that I wanted to explore a path of spiritual healing, but I also still wanted to finish my degrees. So I used that strength. My advisor in graduate school said he had never seen such a difference between a first-year student and a second-year student. And the only difference between that first and second year was I had made that pivot, that turn, to lean towards something bigger than myself. He then invited me to work on a book with him ahead of his other advisees and things like this, to reward what he saw as a transformation. And I never told him about, you know, what I had gone through spiritually. Anyway, so from then I was kind of on two paths. One, working on my spiritual healing and studying what I consider my pastors, the Bible and Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures by Mary Baker Eddy. So I was studying those books and then also studying all my other books and passing prelims and dissertation reviews and things like that.
And, yeah, that's subtle stuff.
And then, you know, but by this time it was great because that prayer part of me led my path so that instead of having a bunch of what I call false starts, like moving to the wrong city or starting in the wrong, it just felt like from there, my path was very clear. I knew we moved to a new city. From that city, I was able to connect with someone. I was instead of applying to 60 schools to try to teach, we moved to the city where I felt like the shepherd was leading us to be. And then
Perfect.
We got there, and then I was able to find that position at an R1 university. And I began to teach some courses there. While I was teaching in my final semester, I didn't know at the time it was my final semester, at least 8 students came in to talk to me. And they weren't talking to me about writing assignments or questions about the schoolwork. They had spiritual crises moments. So one had just converted to Orthodox Judaism. One of them had a parent who passed away.
I hate to do this, but speaking of time,
I
would so joyfully chat with you for another hour or 6. We don't have that. We've been talking with Christy Hanslick. You can find more of her on Christy, Christie, C like Charlie, S like Sam, ChristyCS.com. Christy, this has been an absolute delight. Thank you so much. I hope we get a chance to talk again.
That was fun, Scout. Thank you so much. And yeah, I love stories, as you can tell. So thanks for letting me tell some.
This has been Spiritual Perspectives, looking at life from a spiritual perspective. You can find it. It'll be archived up on ifidknownthen.com. Everybody, treat yourself as a loved one, because you truly are.